from 90.9 WBUR, I'm Chris Siderick. This is a special hour of Radio Boston, performers connecting their life experiences to their art. Filmmaker John Waters says behind his success was the love and support of his parents.
They made me feel safe, actually. They basically were horrified at what I did, but realized that that is what I was going to do, that or prison, really.
George Takei on his journey from Japanese-American internment camp to the bridge of the Starship Enterprise.
I could see the barbed wire fence and the sentry towers right outside my schoolhouse window as I recited the words, "With liberty and justice for all."
Singer Shelby Lynn says she carries her Alabama roots with her wherever she goes.
South's still singing in me. I don't have any intention in losing that.
Changes I can't predict.
That's all coming up next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Is I in control? Gravity.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Chris Siderick. Today we're bringing you a special hour to go with your turkey and stuffing sandwiches, which, by the way, for me is all about the cranberry sauce. I'm a from-the-can kind of guy, but to each his own. We've got some memorable conversations with performers for you today, talking about how they connect their own lives and experiences to their art. Like John Hodgman, best known as the deranged millionaire from The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. Hodgman made his name with ridiculous claims like vacationing in an exclusive gated community on Mars, or saying he wanted to buy the LA Clippers so he could finally own his own herd of humans. His words, not mine. But as he got older, Hodgman decided he wanted to turn to a more truthful and honest brand of comedy. And he talked about that transition with WBUR's Meghna Chakrabarty last November.
My first three books were these imaginary almanacs of fake trivia and invented historical facts. Absurdist humor, basically. And it put me onto The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, where I took on this persona of a deranged authority, the resident expert, and then later the deranged millionaire. And yes, I did quite well with it for a while. But though they were all fake, there was always a certain honesty there. I was honestly preoccupied with the fake history of the hobo wars in the 1920s and those kinds of jokes. But I reached a certain point, I don't think coincidentally when I hit 40, when I didn't feel like being totally fake all the time. And I started doing more stand-up that was much more straightforward storytelling about me, not the deranged millionaire or the resident expert, but me, John Hodgman, a white male monster with terrible facial hair staring down the second half of his life. And really enjoyed it. And then by the time Vacationland started as a stand-up tour, I performed it in Boston before. And then I really wanted to expand it and make a record of it in all of its ungainly glory, and that's the book. And certainly by the time the book came out, everyone was doing fake facts by then. It was no longer cool.
I know, it was actually kind of a problem.
Someone stole my idea.
But as Hodgman explained, a more honest form of comedy required him to be more vulnerable and honest about his own shortcomings.
It's easy to hide behind character when you're doing sort of absurdist humor. Even though I was always John Hodgman, the resident expert on The Daily Show, the resident expert was a disguise. It was a fun disguise because I could be a monster and say horrible things. And even more once I became the deranged millionaire and just talked about, what was it? They call economics the dismal science, right? Because it was invented by Eustace Dismal, who was the first person to propose making smokestacks out of children rather than having children clean them. That was the kind of monstrous stuff I could say. It is harder to just acknowledge that you are kind of a monster in different ways. To speak truly and honestly, I had to become more vulnerable and speak about my family, but mostly I speak about myself because I'm an only child and a narcissist, and the thoughts that go through my head and the privilege that I've enjoyed.
So in this hour, we're going to hear about performing from a place of personal truth and honesty. Like Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter Shelby Lynn, who says it's always the South that's singing in her, wherever she calls home. And Star Trek's George Takei, who talks about his journey from an internment camp for Japanese Americans to the bridge of the Starship Enterprise. But first, we start with filmmaker John Waters. Here he is delivering the commencement address at the Rhode Island School of Design in 2015.
I should say right off that I am really qualified to be your commencement speaker. I was suspended from high school, then kicked out of college in the first marijuana scandal ever on a university campus. I've been arrested several times. I've been known to dress in ludicrous fashions. I've also built a career out of negative reviews and have been called the Prince of Puke by the press.
Waters is, of course, a screenwriter, author, filmmaker, director, and actor who made a name for himself by pushing cultural boundaries with movies like Pink Flamingos, Multiple Maniacs, and Hairspray, which he lovingly refers to as a Trojan horse. So how did the people's pervert, as he's been called, find himself delivering a commencement address anyway? Here's Waters with WBUR's Meghna Chakrabarty in 2017.
I was asked to do it, and I've always been telling people how my age how to be adult delinquents with style. So I've been trying to tell young people how to be juvenile delinquents, because what is a juvenile delinquent today? When I was young, they stole hubcaps. Today, you live with your parents, you're 30, they haven't seen you in 6 months, and you're shutting down the government on your computer. So that's a juvenile delinquent today.
Sounds like a lot of
fun. I like both.
Yeah, I know, I was just going to say.
Well, except hackers don't have fashion.
Well, maybe.
What fashion has started from hackers? No, they have bad posture, and they don't go out. I wish I had a hacker boyfriend. They stay home. They're always up in the bedroom.
I was just going to say hoodies, maybe, but yeah. I'm
maybe
not sure.
Maybe hoodies. Yeah. But yeah, well, I like a hoodie, but that's already been, that was already, rappers made them famous.
That's true.
They didn't create a fashion.
So in the book, and obviously in the speech back at RISD, I mean, as you just mentioned, you told them, today may be the end of your juvenile delinquency, but it should also be the first day of your new adult disobedience. But you also said that being the outsider isn't the way to do it anymore. Why?
No, everybody thinks they're an outsider. That word's over. When I was young, being an outsider was a bad thing you didn't want to be. Today, everybody thinks. Don't you think Trump thinks he's an outsider?
Well, yeah, yes.
Yes, he does.
He said
so
it. He
you
said
know
as much.
Yeah. So what I'm saying is, and Obama probably does too. So what I'm saying is that nowadays we have to sneak in, be a Trojan horse, get inside and screw things up, you know, and change things and be a spy and find out how to change things. Because college students, you shouldn't be studying. You should be out on the street. You can't just have one woman's march. You should have them every day.
Yeah. So you yourself said in the speech that you called Hairspray a Trojan horse.
It was, because it's being done in most high schools in America now, and two men are singing a love song to each other, and even Republicans don't object. It sneaks in. You know, Pink Flamingos was preaching to the converted. Anybody that likes Pink Flamingos was long gone. You know, you weren't going to change anybody's mind there. Hairspray maybe did change people's minds, and that's how you get your political enemies to change their minds, by making them laugh and making them look at something in a way they hadn't seen it.
Yeah.
Not by preaching and cutting them off and being a separatist.
Is it strange to you? I mean, maybe not so strange now, but you kind of talked about it in the speech where you find yourself now as an insider, whereas your whole career, your life's work is built from being that irreverent outsider.
Yeah, it's true. I got the Lifetime Achievement Writers Guild this year, and I was really honored. It's like being at your own funeral, getting to hear the eulogies, but while you're still alive. It is. at the same time, I don't think I've changed. My last movie was about sex addicts and got an NC-17 rating. I was not that different than how I started.
The world just caught
up
with
the world, you? No, I didn't say caught up. Maybe they went down. You could look at it either way. But they have a better sense of humor. I think people want to come into a world that makes them feel uncomfortable. If I can be the guide, I think it makes it a little more safe for them. And I'm always interested in behavior I can't understand.
Yeah.
That's why I'm interested. Anything that's too cut and dry, I get it. I like to be involved in things that make me nervous, and that's what that's youth's responsibility, is to make the generation before them nervous.
Do you think that that's how young people today see that their responsibility is?
I think some of them do, definitely. And I think it's a really time for activism now to bring back the yippies, which used humor as terrorism to embarrass our enemies. But at the same time, I think you should never be a separate. I read every day the Wall Street Journal's editorials because I like to think how my smart enemy thinks.
You know, there was a thing. There's so many parts of your speech and the book which resonated. I'm just going to say it did truly resonate.
But see, that means something's the matter with
you. I think folks who know me will say, yes, there's long been something wrong with me. But a couple of times, you kind of in a joking way talked about trigger warnings.
Yeah.
And how you were like, hey, here's my customary, the trigger warning I have to give.
Which is preposterous. But they're only in rich neighborhoods. Do you think they have trigger warnings in poor schools? They do not.
Because life is challenging.
First of all, I thought you'd go to college to be challenged and be nervous and not be in a comfort zone. Well, if you're that delicate that you can't talk about a social issue, then stay home. You really shouldn't be out in public. You should be in a straitjacket, I guess, or with a dog.
Well, okay. We talk a lot about trigger warnings on this show.
I need one when people say to me they like the new Pope. I wish they'd give me a trigger warning. Because okay. He's bad as all of them because he pats you on the back and doesn't change anything. He's worse. Anita Bryant helped gay rights more than he does because it got people angry and led to act up.
You're get a lot of Bostonians all fired up now.
That's all right. That's my job. It's called make trouble. And, oh, I can't stand him. I need a trigger warning when they say, oh, he's so much better. He hasn't changed one thing. He's going to give women a year of mercy to forgive them for having an abortion. Well, when he gets pregnant, then he can forgive people for having abortions.
He did say who is he to judge about
gayness? I guess so, considering what's going on in the Catholic Church. He's got plenty to judge if you ask me. You asked me about trigger warnings. So sometimes I need reverse trigger warnings.
Okay. I want to ask you about your parents.
Yep.
Because I was really moved. I mean, I've got little ones, but I was really moved when you turned to parents in the RISD audience and you said, hey, you know, if you've got a kid who grows up and tattoos her entire face, like, make the best of it. She might become an artist in Paris.
Yeah,
right?
She'll own a fancy tattoo. But, you know, I always say to the parents also, these entitled brats, they think you're supposed to understand everything. Like, you just got horn implants and they're supposed to like it. I feel sorry for parents sometimes that they have to accept this. I always said, my parents never saw Pink Flamingos, but what parent would be glad their child made Pink Flamingos? No parent.
But didn't
and
you,
that was the point.
Wasn't your father who gave you the money
yes,
to make it?
Yes, he did,
it?
And I paid him back with interest. But it was the opposite of a Hollywood pitch. If I had told him what it was about, he would have said no. Usually when you get money for a movie, you have to say, and this is what happens, everything. He would, like, put his hands in his ears if I told him what was going to happen.
Yeah, well, tell me more, because I want to know more about where Waters came from.
Well, they made me feel safe, actually. They basically were horrified at what I did, but realized that I was very young and I was getting these films shown. I was going around the country getting them shown. That is what I was going to do, that or prison, really. And so they better encourage it. They liked that I set up my own business, that I learned how to do it. They just wished the product was a little different. I mean, they liked Hairspray. They were so relieved when Hairspray came out. But even my last film, A Dirty Shame, my father said, well, it was funny, but I hope I never see it again. I did get my sense of humor in a way from my parents.
And your mother and her passion for Queen Elizabeth?
Well, she loved Queen Elizabeth. Yes, I was raised with the tyranny of good taste. That's why I rebelled. But I couldn't have had the career I had if I didn't have know the rules that my mother taught me. This great, my mother thought she was Queen Elizabeth. I mean, not, she wasn't crazy, but you know, her idea of a vacation, they would go to London and she'd wear sensible shoes and go bird watching in the deep country villages. Yes, so my mother loved all that. But in a way, that is what led to this, because I learned the rules. And I agree with her in some things very completely. Like in Serial Mom, Kathleen Turner kills Patty Hearst for wearing white shoes after Labor Day. I'm very right-wing on white shoes. I believe you should die. And even Anna Wintour at Vogue says you can wear white now. She's wrong.
And what about seersucker?
Seersucker is, I think you can't wear that after Easter, right?
Yeah.
And velvet before Thanksgiving. There's a lot of rules, and they should be taken seriously.
All right. Well, so I still want to know a little bit more about what you think about how young people can make trouble today. Because you talked about politics, you talked about protesting a little, but what about in art, in the world of art, like, or in film or television?
Can
you make trouble?
Yes, you can.
Okay.
But not by getting on your parents' nerves, by getting on the coolest kid that's 2 years older than your nerves. That's how you change things, because you startle them. And you have to think of a new way to surprise people. It changes. Now you can do anything. So trying to be shocking usually is trying too hard, I think. It doesn't work. Hollywood makes $100 million gross-out movies now that aren't funny.
Yeah.
So I don't want, I'm not interested. That's not new anymore, certainly. I never tried to top the ending of Pink Flamingos. I knew that would be a dead end, really. So the only shocking thing I did was when I made Hairspray and made a movie with Divine. It was a PG family movie. You have to go with the times, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And today, everything is so divided that I'm not as separate as I always say when I do my show, did Trump ever say anything funny? Well, I thought it was funny when he called Elizabeth Warren Pocahontas. And Elizabeth Warren has never said a funny thing, even though I agree with her completely.
Do you think that like there's different ways or different platforms? Like to a certain degree, I look at social media and I think there's shocking stuff on there every day. But
see, I don't look. I want to be harder to reach. Anybody from my past that I'm curious about, I've stalked their homes. I already know what they look like. And the only reason you have social media is to see the people you remember that you wanted to have sex with when you were young. And that is a good way to look them up. Yes, that's the only reason to be on Facebook. Because I don't care what you had for lunch.
You're telling
me. I'm too busy. I don't care what you had for lunch. It's not that fascinating.
That I completely agree with you. This is one of those awkward moments where I'm like, professionally, should I be laughing or not?
That's the whole point. It's kind of humor that makes you a little uncomfortable at first. Like tweeting. Why give away my free material? What am I going to put in my books if every day I have to crack jokes for free?
Well, I want to talk to you. We got a couple more minutes left before I got to let you go. And I just want to ask you, there's maybe by virtue, it's the fact of where you are in your career, but some of your other works are getting a new lease on life, right? Like Multiple Maniacs.
Yeah. And the most ridiculous thing is last time I looked, Multiple Maniacs was 100% favorable reviews on Rotten Tomatoes,
wow.
Which more than any movie I ever made, which is ludicrous because it's one of the most hideous movies I ever made. And when it came out, it got not one good review. So it just goes to show that the luxury of time can change how something is that you're watching this movie now, Multiple Maniacs, which is in a time warp, in a capsule, really, seeing it from another era.
Yeah.
And it takes away the edge and it adds even more in a way because all the kids, the young people that weren't even born when I made this movie say to me, well, acid must have been pretty good back then. And it was.
It's going to be part of the Criterion collection.
It is already.
It is.
They did Pink Flamingos, so it's great.
Yeah.
And it was released by Janus Films in the theaters, one of the most classy old art distributors that did Godard and Truffaut when I was young and everything. And then to see Multiple Maniacs in the same library is really, really a wonderful moment in my creative life.
It's fantastic. Now, one last thing before I let you go, because I promised someone I would ask you about this. You mentioned Divine a little earlier. I recently had a re-exposure to Divine's work, but through a completely different channel because I was binge-watching RuPaul's Drag Race.
Yep.
And season 7...
Well, I was a judge on that.
They redid the
scenes for my movies. So yeah.
I was pulling for Ginger. I thought she was amazing.
The one that played Edith
yes.
was my favorite. Me too. I would have voted for her too. Nothing against the one who won. I don't remember the one who won. I do remember the one that played Edith. She was great.
And sadly, she didn't win, but I was pulling for her. But I was just wondering what was it like to do the show?
It was great, and I've known Ru forever. And what Ru is, why his great success, he's really crossed over. He won the Emmy, the show. This was millions of people are watching. I give him great credit. But one of the reasons is he also has a really great look out of drag.
Yeah.
And drag queens don't. They only concentrate on what they look like with drag, and then they hide how they look. Even Divine, until the end, didn't quite know how to look out of drag. At the end, he wore very fancy men's suits and everything. Divine didn't want to be a woman. He wasn't transgendered in any way. He wanted to be Godzilla.
That was filmmaker, director, author, and pop culture icon John Waters talking with Meghna Chakrabarty on Radio Boston in 2017. Stay with us. Coming up, Star Trek legend George Takei on how being imprisoned in a Japanese-American internment camp as a 5-year-old child changed his perspective and sense of place in America. I'm Chris Sidorek. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to a special edition of Radio Boston. I'm Chris Sidorek. All this hour, we're hearing from performers about how they connect their own lives and experiences to their art. Before the break, filmmaker and pop culture icon John Waters talked about how his perspective as a self-described outsider influenced his art throughout his career. Now, we turn to another voice you may recognize.
The conference is at Camp Kittleberg, near the Romulan border. I'm sending the exact coordinates on a coded frequency.
That's, of course, Mr. Sulu, helmsman of the Starship Enterprise. But George Takei didn't stop by Radio Boston to discuss the Federation or the Prime Directive. He joined Meghna Chakrabarty this past May to discuss his play Allegiance. Allegiance is a musical based on Takei's own family's experience of being imprisoned in a Japanese-American internment camp during World War II. He talked with us about how that experience changed him forever and what it was like to journey from enemy of America to beloved TV and movie personality. And he started with this chilling story of his family being taken into custody by the authorities when he was just 5 years old.
I was 5 years old when I just turned five, just a few weeks after my fifth birthday, when soldiers came marching up our driveway, stomped up the front porch, with their fists began pounding on the front door, and my brother and I happened to be in the living room, and we were terrified. My father, who was packing back in the bedroom, came out, answered the door, and literally at gunpoint, we were ordered out of our home. My father gave my brother and me little pieces of luggage to carry, and we followed him out onto the driveway and waited for our mother to come out. And when she finally emerged, she had our baby sister in one arm and a huge duffel bag in the other, and tears were streaming down her cheeks. That was a long time ago for me, but I will never be able to forget that terrifying morning.
And you eventually, not immediately, but eventually were sent to one of the internment camps in Arkansas.
That's right.
Okay.
We were taken from our home to the horse stables of Santa Anita Racetrack, and from a two-bedroom home on Garnet Street, we were assigned one horse stall, still pungent with the smell of horse manure, and that was to be our home for about 3 months while the camps were being built. And then when the construction was completed, we were put on trains with armed guards at both ends of each car and taken two-thirds of the way across the country to the swamps of southeastern Arkansas.
And this was the, I hope I'm saying it correctly, the Rower
War? Rower.
Rower War Relocation Center, a wonderful Orwellian name there. and so you were five. What was life in the camp like?
Well, on the way there, I remember asking my father, where are we going? And it took him a while. He had to think a little bit, but he said, we're going on a long vacation to a place called Arkansas. Arkansas? That sounded exotic to me. We were going on a vacation to Arkansas. It could have been Hawaii. It had the same exotic sound. And for me, actually, it was a fun experience, catching pollywogs in the clear water of the bayou there and watching them spring legs and turn into frogs, catching butterflies. And, you know, we heard that particularly at twilight, strange sounds coming from beyond the barbed wire fence. It was a forest, but I called it the jungle. And, you know, there were the cawing sounds and the hooting sounds and chirping sounds. And I told my brother there were dinosaurs out there in the jungle, and the barbed wire fence was to keep the dinosaurs out.
So that's the innocence of childhood in the midst of imprisonment for nothing more than ancestry.
Children are amazingly adaptable. You know, what would have been grotesquely abnormal became normality in our lives. It became routine for me to line up three times a day in to eat a lousy food in a noisy mess hall. It became normal for me to go with my father and brother to bathe in a mass shower. And it became normal for me to go to school in a black tar paper barrack and begin the school day with the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag. I could see the barbed wire fence and the sentry towers right outside my schoolhouse window as I recited the words, with liberty and justice for all. An innocent kid, totally oblivious of the stinging irony in those words.
How much later did that horrific irony settle on you?
Well,
I mean, how old were you when it finally dawned on you that your nation had treated you as an enemy of the state, essentially?
Well, as a teenager, I became very curious about what I was beginning to learn about my childhood, and so I became a voracious reader. I read all the history books that I could get my hands on, couldn't find anything about my childhood imprisonment. I read civics books, and I read about the high ideals of American democracy. All men are created equal, endowed with an inalienable right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And I couldn't relate that to what I needed to be my childhood imprisonment. The only person I could go to was my father.
Yeah.
And I had many long, sometimes heated after-dinner conversations with my father about our internment.
Heated? Why?
I knew about the ideals, you know, what democracy is supposed to be. And I said, Daddy, I would have organized my friends at school and gone downtown to the federal building and demonstrated. And he said, well, I suspect you would have done that. But I had to think about your mother, you, your brother, and sister. They were pointing guns at me.
Mm-hmm.
If something happened to me, what do you think would happen to you guys? And I understood, but I kept saying, but Daddy, it was wrong. It's against the Constitution. It was, you should have protested it. I mean, there is no one more arrogant than an idealistic teenager. I gave my father a hard time. And some of the things I said, I regret to this day.
Yeah.
And back then, I didn't apologize for it. And one of the great regrets I have is that I never apologized to the man that I love so much, who bore the awful burden of the pain and the anxiety and the loss and the humiliation and the rage of all that happened, wave after wave of goading insults and deprivation. And this arrogant teenager gave him a hard time.
Your father, he didn't even live long enough to hear his nation apologize to him, right?
That's
because
right.
President Ronald Reagan in 1988, almost 50 years later, finally, on behalf of the United States, apologized to the citizens who had been interned.
That's correct. He died in 1979. Never to know that there would be an apology.
So I've read that you have said that this musical, Allegiance, in part is your apology to your father?
The last scene in Allegiance, where a very aged Sam Kimura, the character I play, apologizes again, after his father is gone, to his memory of his father. And so every night when I perform that scene, I am apologizing to my father for all that arrogant teenager put him through. But I am not in the Boston production.
Yeah, I was just going to say. We don't want to mislead folks.
Yes.
Because
that's why I'm so excited to be here, because for the first time, I will be able to see Allegiance. I've been in it since 2012, and I've never seen Allegiance.
The roles that you play are being played by
a guy named
Gary Ng. Yeah, and the young Sammy Kimura is being played by Sam Tanabe.
Yes,
so it's
and
a great cast.
He was with us in the Broadway production.
Yeah, so I mean, we could talk for hours. And unfortunately, I do not have hours there's so many tragedies about the internment of Japanese Americans. I mean, there's the loyalty oath that citizens were asked to sign, and your family was moved to another internment camp in California on the California-Oregon border. But I'm dying to ask you the following question, so forgive me if I fall all over myself, because yes, I am sitting across from Mr. Sulu. I will admit, I am a fan. But in 1966, when you were one of the starring roles in Star Trek, the 1966 version of Star Trek, one of its great draws and breakthroughs was that it was Gene Roddenberry's vision of equality and diversity put on television.
In the future.
In the future.
23rd century.
But, I mean, just 22 years before that, you had been interned by the U.S. government. I mean, did people on the set know that? Did anyone at Star Trek know?
Okay. They knew. Okay. In between scenes, we chit-chat, you know. You run out of things to talk about, and people talk about their childhood, and I shared some of my childhood memories with them, and they were initially aghast. They had never heard of American citizens of Japanese ancestry being incarcerated. So we chatted about that just casually, set aside conversation.
I mean, how did Leonard Nimoy react to that?
Oh, Leonard was incensed, yeah. and he was really outraged that our democracy did something like that, as were many of the others. Walter Koenig, a Jewish American whose parents fled Russia because of the pogroms. Mm-hmm. And Nichelle Nichols, of course, you know, being an African-American,
right,
understood the kind of racism that would happen after an event like Pearl Harbor. Yeah. We were seen as an enemy. At 5 years old, I was classified as enemy alien. I was neither. I was, you know, a kid. How could I be an enemy? And I was born and raised in Los Angeles. My mother was born and raised in Sacramento, California. My father was born in Japan, but brought to San Francisco as a boy, and he was reared and educated in San Francisco, and he called himself a San Franciscan all his life. I said, Daddy, you spent more of your life in Los Angeles. Why do you call yourself a San Franciscan? He said, once a San Franciscan, always a San Franciscan. We were Americans,
yeah,
and yet, because of our faces, we were considered enemy aliens.
I mean, so I wanted to ask you about the irony of then being on Star Trek in this sort of play-acted utopia, mm-hmm, of diversity. And also, maybe layered upon that irony, it was 1966, so America still, to this day, it's still grappling with issues of civil rights. And we're still, what, 22 years away from President Reagan officially apologizing. I mean, did it ever seem, you were a working actor then, a young working actor, but did it ever seem strange to you that the place that you were able to, one of the places you were able to find complete acceptance was on, you know, on a starship in the fictional future?
Well, you know, in junior high school, well, my father told us about, you know, our democracy being a participatory democracy. And he urged us to be active in our society. And he offered to buy these cardboard campaign boards, you know, when I was in school. And he said, why don't you support your friend Bobby Thompson for athletic commissioner? And I did. And then the next semester he would say, why don't you get Bobby to support you for health commissioner. And I was eventually voted student body president. So, you know, from the time that I was a teenager, my father was kind of pulling the strings, but I thought it was me that was doing it, you know. And I loved being popular, and I was elected student body president. I thought it was a great thing. And at the end of that semester, the outstanding senior would be given an award called the American Legion Award. And when I told my father that I was a candidate for the American Legion Award, he told me something about the American Legion. Right after Pearl Harbor, the American Legion was one of the fiercest, vociferous advocate for Lock Up the Japs movement. And He was so moved by the fact that I would be nominated to be a candidate for the American Legion Award, the highest award a senior can get. And I wound up receiving that honor. And so I guess for my father, it was a lot of mixed feelings.
Yeah.
pride and some kind of remembered pain and the irony of American democracy. And so just, you know, less than a decade after imprisonment, things like that were happening. Things were changing. But it was because my father urged all of us, my brother and my sister, to be actively involved.
Yeah. We've just got 30 seconds to go, George Takei. When people come to see the Speakeasy Stage Company's production, I mean, why do you think it's important for people to see Allegiance now?
People may know about the internment intellectually, but as a drama, that humanizes the story. And with music, which has the power of hitting people deep within their heart, is a powerful way of getting people to identify with us as human beings. And we hear the sniffles and some sobs. And, of course, at the end, when we come out for our curtain call, it's that spontaneous standing ovation. We are reaching people not just intellectually, but through the heart.
That's George Takei, who, by the way, ended his interview with the traditional Star Trek farewell.
Live long and prosper.
He spoke with WBUR's Meghna Chakrabarty last May. Stay with us. Coming up, Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter Shelby Lynn talks about how growing up in Alabama still influences her music decades later. I'm Chris Sidorek, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Chris Sidorek. In this special hour of Radio Boston, we're looking back at some memorable conversations with performers, talking about how they connect their own lives and experiences to their art. Before the break, we heard from Star Trek legend George Takei about the emotional journey of turning his childhood experience being held captive in a Japanese-American internment camp into the stage musical Allegiance. Finally today, we bring you a conversation with Grammy Award-winning singer and songwriter Shelby Lynn.
Changes I can't predict. Seas are in control.
She says that she's gone on her own journey from her childhood home in Mobile, Alabama, to Nashville, Tennessee, to Palm Springs, California. But wherever she goes, it's always the South that's singing in her. She came in to speak with WBUR's Anthony Brooks in 2015 and started with the song we're hearing now, Sold the Devil Sunshine.
Cause we sold the devil a dash of sunshine. Yeah.
Does not get any better than that on Radio Boston. That's Shelby Lynn singing Sold the Devil Sunshine from her brand new album, I Can't Imagine. She's joined by Ben Peeler on guitar. And Shelby Lynn, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
Great to have you.
Great to be here.
Oh my God, I've got to let my heart sort
I'm
of
I'm thrilled
calm.
To be here. I've been waiting on y'all to call me.
Well, we're glad to have you. Tell us something about that song, Sold the Devil Sunshine.
Well, we wrote
so
it.
Beautiful.
We wrote it. Ben and I wrote it. And it's his music and my words I had laying around. And, you know, I just wrote that song because I just wanted to, you know, make the devil mad.
So your words and Ben's music. So how does that work? I mean, do the words come first? Ben adds the music? How does that work?
It comes both ways. So we just wanted to write together.
Yeah. It's the first time I think I've written with you. Yeah. You wrote most of the stuff that you do, you write yourself.
Yeah, I do, but, you know, I like the male flavor every now and again.
And she had the words, and we just kind of sat down, and I was feeling very staple singing.
That's right.
But I didn't tell her that, and we just let it go.
Yeah. Oh, and God. I'm generally usually easy to please.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lie.
But Ben said, uh-huh.
You said that on the radio.
So, Shelby, you've been living in California now for the past 16 years.
Yeah.
Do I have that right?
That
originally from the South, mm-hmm. Alabama specifically.
Yeah.
Why'd you head west?
Well, I love California. I'm not going to lie. I mean, like, it's got everything I need, you know.
Yeah.
Don't let me tell you what.
But we mentioned we use that that phrase, you can take the girl out of the South, but you can't take the South out of the girl.
That is the truth.
Yeah.
I mean, South's still singing in me.
Mm.
And I don't have any intention in losing that. I'm too old for that.
Yeah.
I just take it with me. You know, I think it's like anything. You keep the good and toss out the bag.
But your relocation westward is a theme throughout this new album, right? Including the title track called I Can't Imagine.
Mm-hmm.
So what can't you imagine?
Well, it's just, you know, that particular song is about I can't imagine having a friend being in that much pain.
Mm.
But the song talks about my kind of journey on the California coast and leaving the coast and winding up in the California desert.
Mm.
So that's been home now for all that time.
Right. So the next song you're going to do for us, Backdoor Front Porch.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you say something about that before you do it? Tell us what this is about.
Well, I wrote it about Highway 43 in South Alabama. And if you're on, if you're leaving Mobile going north on Highway 65 to get where I live, you get off on Highway 43. And that's what it's about.
All right. Shelby Lynn doing Backdoor Front Porch here on Radio Boston.
How met a morning, dew drips off a mailbox, where a letter stays, informing me to get back on a big airplane. Been making memories in the wrong place, the wrong address. Oh, 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 but I always go back in my mind to back door, front porch, window. Back door, front porch, window. Back door, front porch.
That's Shelby Lynn playing Backdoor Front Porch. It's off her new album, I Can't Imagine. She's accompanied by Ben Peeler on lap steel guitar. They'll be performing tomorrow night at Johnny D's in Somerville. Shelby Lynn, thank you again
for
that. Beautiful.
Appreciate it.
So really, am I reading that right? Expressing some real homesickness about the South or for the South or not?
Sure, sometimes.
Yeah.
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, that's what I heard in that song.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. So tell us more about that. I mean, what inspired that song?
Well, you always miss where you're from.
Yeah.
So it's just about that.
Yeah. Boy, it's... And this image, back door, front porch,
mm-hmm.
window, is that sort of...
Well, everybody knows what that is.
Yeah.
Everybody's probably had one. of those. My back door, front porch, and window are very clear to me where I grew up.
Yeah.
So I can just see them. So I hope that's what everybody can do.
Right. Sort of brings you.
Yeah. You know, it just feels good. I remember sitting on the porch swing when I was a youngin, on the front porch. So it just, I can be there here.
Yeah.
And I like pictures and music.
Mm. You do it beautifully. Your songs are so personal and so beautiful.
I tend to get a little personal.
Do they just sort of tumble out of you, or is it like ripping open a vein and bleeding?
Well, you know, it's not always painful. Sometimes it's good to get it out.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think pain comes along with the blues. You got to have the blues, you know, the blues sing to everybody.
Yeah. I was reading a review of I Can't Imagine on...
Oh, don't do that.
Well, let me just reread you what this said. This was at AL.com. That's AL for your home state, Alabama.
What said about the review?
What did he say?
Charge.
Yeah.
No,
not that one.
Well, this was a good review. So okay. It said, there's a fresh spirit to your album that makes it feel as if Shelby Lynn has consolidated the lessons of her experience, gathered her powers, and started looking at things from a new perspective.
I like that power part. I always knew I had superpowers.
But does that bit about a new perspective ring true?
New perspective. Absolutely. You know, I think when you get old, you start looking at everyone.
Who's old? There's no one old in this
older
room. Older, okay.
You start looking at everyone as like you should have been doing the other 40 years. Mm. It's the same. And you know, it is all the same. We're the same.
Yeah. You're, among other things, well known for your album, I Am Shelby Lynn, which came out in 2000, for which you won a Grammy for Best New Artist, even though it was your sixth album. And I've heard you refer to that album as coming from a vulnerable, desperate place. What place did this new album, I Can't Imagine, come from?
Well, we had a good time making it. It was definitely a different place.
Yeah.
I mean, it's 16 years ago.
Yeah, right.
So... that's really kind of a long time.
Yeah, it really is.
But I learned a lot so much on making I Am and through all the other records I've made between this one and those. So it's each time I was talking to my sister about it and saying how, you know, making a record is great and I love it and I can't wait to get on the road, but I don't want to sit around and listen to it. You know, it's like a little notch in my, what would you call it, my gun handle there?
Yeah, or your belt.
Holster.
Oh, my revolver.
Holster. There you go. Yeah. Yeah. The one we made you check at the reception.
Yeah. That one.
Yeah, yeah, right. Okay, good. It's great hearing just you and Ben in here together.
We love that. We do that every chance we get. We run them off, don't we?
Yeah, so how does that contrast with what you're going to be doing tomorrow night at Johnny D's? Because you'll be playing with a full band, right?
Yeah, we'll have the whole band, and I mean... you know, it's fun to do it like this because we have the freedom to kind of do more, but it's really great to hear them. I mean, I'm a huge fan of the I Am record, and I know a lot of people are, and I think that one gets realized really well. And then with the new record, it's a great realization of that, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, they're not by any means exactly like the record. But with a band, especially good players, and you can really bring the things in the songs that you're hearing in your head when we play them like this, but they're not actually happening. You can bring those things out, finally. There's a keyboard player who can hit that part, or there's somebody who can do that harmony, finally. Yeah. You know, and that's the nice thing. I think both of these are good.
Yeah.
In fact, I think we should just go back and record every album acoustically and sell that version, too.
That's fine.
Why not?
I'm into that.
So, Shelby, we've got time for one more song, and I understand you're going to do Following You, which I know you're going to be playing next. Tell us a little bit about this song.
This is about being in the woods with Daddy when I was a little young and shooting 22 rifles. Following you as night falls on water in the morning.
That's Grammy Award winner Shelby Lynn talking with Anthony Brooks in May of 2015. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Jamie Bologna, Paris Alston, and Zoe Mitchell. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Chris Siderick. Join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.
Waiting on direction from your voices. You're just a king, only king, but you made all your choices. Following you, even though you